introduce our next speaker. It's Wendy Woodford, who's based at the University of Western Cape in South Africa. She's published widely in the fields of gender and post-colonialism, as well as in literary animal studies, her most renowned work being The Animal Gaze. She's currently co-editing with Susan McHugh a collection entitled Indigenous Creatures, Native Knowledges and the Arts, Animal Studies in Modern Worlds, and that's with Palgrave. So over to you, Wendy.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And thank you to the organisers for the conference and the other papers. I'm talking about two lionesses, two conservation idols. The 17th meeting of CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Fauna and Flora, took place in downtown Johannesburg in October. Shockingly, the proposal to ban all trade in lion from the heads that are hung as trophies to the bones exported to the so-called Asian medical industry was defeated. Countries such as Zimbabwe objected to the proposal, arguing that the coexistence of people and lions can only be protected by putting value on lions. With tiger farming banned in China, lion bone from South Africa will now fill the lucrative gap in the Asian market. Trophy hunting and canned hunting will continue apace to bring in overseas currency. Estimates vary, but according to Blood Lions, which is an NPO campaigning against canned hunting, fewer than 3,000 lions exist in the wild in South Africa. At the same time, approximately 7,000 live in cages on about 200 farms and breeding facilities. Canned hunting operations, under the guise of conservation, donate neotenous cubs to petting zoos. Winsome young lions walk with tourists. Not only do these practices, which habituate lions to humans, render them unfit for any return to the wild, but so does their genetic inferiority. But when they reach, before they reach maturity, the juvenile lions are returned to the canned hunting farms, where they will be shot for $100,000 or so apiece. These operations are big business, owned mostly by right-wing supporters of the apartheid regime, but backed by people in government, as well as by those like corrupt rangers and veterinarians who purport to care for non-human animals. For Carey Wolf, the framing of biopolitics decides what we recognize and what we don't, what counts and what doesn't, and it also determines the consequence of falling outside the frame. The lions certainly are cast into a thanatopolitics, which assigns monetary value to their body parts rather than allotting them any ethical concern. At the same time, the symbolism of lions recurs locally on South African banknotes, in advertising. Sipho Kings, the Mail and Guardian reporter on CITES, was surprised that the symbolism was not enough to swing the vote. But Nicole Shukin derides such a belief as a liberal fantasy of culturally transcending the materiality of nature, arguing instead that animal signs and metaphors are key symbolic resources of capital's reproduction. I will read the figuring of the lionesses in Saving the White Lions, One Woman's Battle for Africa's Most Sacred Animals by Linda Tucker, and the novel Green Lion by Henrietta Rose Innes. And I will read them against this background of biopolitics and the discursive operations of animal capital. Conservation becomes a species of narrative, as both writers foreground charismatic lionesses, Mara and Sekhmet, respectively. This is Green Lion. So I'm actually looking at a non-fiction Saving the White Lions and a fictional Green Lions, and looking at the parallels between them, which are quite extraordinary, actually. So Mara and Sekhmet, I also argue, that they're charismatic lionesses who are made to perform themselves through their characters and their names. And the figuring of these lionesses promotes the aesthetics and sensuality of a particularly personal form of conservation for both human and lion. But the outcomes differ. The non-fictional text broadens into post-colonial narrative of restitution and redemption, while the novel despairs of attempts at conservation, which it satirizes. Quite interesting, because normally most animal stories are sad, and the non-fictional one actually, well, it isn't. Saving the White Lions follows on from Tucker's Mystery of the White Lions, in which these very particular lions, not albinos, but leucistic, that is, with a recessive gene, are situated within indigenous knowledges. The founding moment of Tucker's passion for the White Lions began when she first encountered Maria Corsa, a lion shaman. In 1991, Tucker and some friends were trapped in the middle of an angry pride of lions in Timbavati, at dusk in an immobilized open Land Rover. Corsa appeared seemingly out of nowhere, walking through the lions with two grandchildren on foot and another on her back. Miraculously, her presence calmed the lions so that an occupant of the vehicle could walk through the shadowy bush back to the camp to get help. Tucker subsequently returned to her life as a fashion model in Europe until an illness, like a shamanist calling, motivated her to return to South Africa in order to study lion shamanism with Corsa. Saving the White Lions tells of her efforts to do just that, against almost impossible odds, buying a tract of land in Timbavati for her saved White Lion family in the midst of often hostile neighbours. Green Lion presents a chronologically fractured narrative circling around Sekhmet, the lioness, with Khan as a focaliser. Mark, his estranged friend, has been attacked and badly mauled by Sekhmet's mate Dimitri in the Lion House where he worked. This is in Cape Town. Unable psychologically to visit Mark in hospital, Khan becomes the unpaid keeper of Sekhmet, now alone after the euthanizing of her mate. Gradually, Khan is able to face the buried trauma of the death of Mark's sister 20 years before, who, partly due to his negligence, was taken by a large predator on a fenced-off Table Mountain, repopulated with indigenous animals. We hope that Rose Innes isn't being prescient in this novel as she was in quite a couple of the others of hers. Conservation, as both Tucker and Rose Innes imagine it, depend on a nostalgic restoration of the past when lions were plentiful. In the novel, the small zoo has a backbreeding project with two lions, the male from a Russian circus, the female from a safari park, obviously a cover-up for a cant hunting operation. Realistically, these lions would have been genetically weak and inbred, but Rose Innes sidesteps such possibilities, having the two lions touted as the zoo's only attraction. Back from extinction, come and meet our breeding pair, Dimitri and Sekhmet, the first black-maned lions in the Cape since 1858. Nostalgic images of the lions, the last black-maned lions, including a copy of Rembrandt's sketch, are kept in the zoo. Sekhmet is mythologized in the narrative, partly by epigraphs of cross-cultural quotations, Atwood's poem about Sekhmet, Jan van Riebeck's diary about marauding lions, the Bushman informant Gabor's dream of a fellow lion. Tucker locates Mara exclusively within lion shamanism. From Corsa, the lion queen, she learns that the white lions are the holiest animals on the African continent. To harm a white lion is to harm the land. To kill a white lion is to kill the soul of Africa. Timbavati, the ancient Tsonga name for the home of the white lions, can be translated as the place where the star lions came down. Credovo Somazulu Mutwa, an eminent lion shaman, and Sunusi, the highest rank of the native medicine person, explained that lions came, and he means literally, from Sirius and the Orion constellation. He takes the significance of the white lions beyond Africa. White lions hold a secret that could save humanity at this time of crisis. They are the guardians of the human soul, and they invite us to reawaken our own souls in order to protect the planet. It might be easy to mock the grandiosity of such beliefs, but Tucker's quest to save the white lions is endorsed by First Nations leaders internationally, who all nurture prophecies about white animals, considered sacred signs from nature and the fulfillment of ancient prophecy. But whiteness in humans might be more problematic. Donna Haraway in Primate Visions contextualizes the whiteness of much publicized women primatologists as a romance of race with its plot mapped out in the history of Western expansion. While this critique could be leveled at Tucker to some extent, the photogenic ex-model returns from Europe to Africa to save African predators for the whole of humanity. Her unreserved commitment to the teachings of Khosa and Mutwa reverses the colonial imaginary. Not only does she learn with humility from a Tsonga shaman and a Zulu Sanusi, but she grounds animist logic, which according to Garuba, usually reabsorbs historical time into the matrices of myth and symbol. Her acceptance of pre-colonial beliefs does not approximate this kind of generic New Ageism, which flattens differences and subtleties. And she's very aware of the political difficulties that her two teachers experience and have experienced. In her novel, Rose Innes foregrounds the colonial imaginary and its contemporary relevance in the depiction of Mark's family home as overwhelmed by taxidermied animals, all killed in colonial hunting practices. Rachel Poliquin suggests that taxidermy always tells us stories about particular cultural moments, about the spectacles of nature, our assumptions of superiority. The taxidermied animals here are murdered embodiments of racialized colonial assumptions about indigenous animals, a biopolitics which is endured in the present day. For the adult Khan, visiting Mark's bereft mother in her huge home, the aura of death and chemicals still shocks. The passage was walled, this is a quote, wall-to-wall furred, feathered, clawed, and winged. And then he comes across a green lion which has suffered terrible indignities, and it's very disturbed by that, it's killed by Mark's ancestor, but it's been painted green, its eyes been taken out, it's got a tennis ball in its mouth. What he realizes later is that it's been made into a talisman for this group called the Green Lion. Khan is very derogatory about them, calling them animal nutters. Be interesting to see what would happen if he met Lynn Tucker. But he longs for, and they long for, the sensual embodied connection with the captive lions in the zoo. Tantamount to an orientalizing of these non-human animals, their human desires take no cognizance of violating the animal's boundaries. Generally, animals like Dimitri and Sekhmet living in captivity are made to perform themselves as surely as if they were in circus. Where, Peter Tate argues, the danger for an animal living an unnatural life without liberty lies in transgressing how codes of speciesism were and are performed as part of animal identity. As I write this paper, Bloodlines reports the mauling of a young boy in a petting zoo, throat slit by a young, he didn't die, but his throat was slit by a young lion. I refer briefly to Douglas Livingston's poem, The Zoo Affair, which is about this passion that a man has for a tiger in a zoo. And I extrapolate from that this fetishizing of the predator could possibly harbor a death wish, but it certainly has a desire which is madly Edenic on the part of the human for an animal apparently uncontaminated by human touch, as though her timeless animality can be made to compensate for the sterilities of the civilized world. Poliquin confirms that animals seem to offer themselves as direct access to truth, to a reality that exists above, beyond, prior to representation. Surprisingly, Tucker actually admits that she can understand why people want to have beautiful animals to kind of get to their essence. And this Green Lion group want to devour the energies of the wild to use as a remedy. What happens in the novel is that Khan is seduced by an animal nutter, a young woman called Mossi, which means little sparrow in Afrikaans, and their sex is heightened because they are right next to the lion's cage, and there's this kind of danger and sound of the lioness. But Khan is drawn to the lioness and longs for a kind of symphysis with her. Sekhmet, and I'm quoting, had come to the bars and laid herself out, was pressing her length against them, as if offering her warmth or seeking his. He could feel her heat against his cheeks and forehead, smell her reek, At last his fingers came to rest very lightly on her spine. He must have exhaled and then drawn in the lion's breath, a potion, a sleeping draught. The next morning he wakes up and the lioness has been sprung from the cage. If lion bodies are sacrificed to self-centered human desires for trans-species connections in the novel, Tucker's longing to hold Mara are figured differently, if not unproblematically. The front cover here pictures a blissful union of an attractive woman and a beautiful white lion. The lioness is etherealized, her color renders her otherworldly, magical, rare. Both human and animal are prone in yellow grass, which sets off the darkness of the woman's hair and segues into the astonishing lightness of the lioness's coat. This photograph was actually taken when Tucker managed to get into a canned hunting operation, and they clandestinely took this photograph. So it is actually quite amazing that they could feel this joy. And perhaps I'm being sentimental about this, but it certainly seems, you know, there's this kind of search for this time, this moment, but at the same time, it's undermined by the target. What is it called? The
crosshairs.
Thank you. So, granted, the capturing of this image might suggest a performance of emotion, but the harmony between lioness and woman contradicts biopolitical hierarchies with any longing for a timeless romance or a reality beyond representation queered by the gun sights. So Tucker, we've read, constructs all white lions as having a very specific spiritual provenance and presence. But this Mara, it was foretold by Corsa that a lioness was going to be born outside the Timbavati and that Tucker would have to save her and bring her back. She gets born in Bethlehem, South Africa, on Christmas Day. And Tucker the next day actually managed managed to get in, sort of posing as, I don't know what she posed as, but it was like going into a house of horrors for her. And she actually holds this little white lioness with blue eyes. And the whole story of this rescuing of the lionesses, of this Mara, is like a fairy tale. It really is amazing. And that she actually rescues this lioness, but it takes her 5 years to get the lioness, who's then being impregnated via a wicked veterinarian who's trying to get her to produce more white lions, because in terms of animal capital, they are much more valuable than tawny lions. Then she gets her to the Karoo and the. It's too much to go into detail, but it's complete with corrupt politicians, corrupt policemen, the works. In another instance, she lies down with the lioness when she has the lioness in the Karoo preparatory to getting her back to Timbavati. But she's very cagey, if that's the right word, because her partner is a lion ecologist. I mean, what a perfect match. But she's very worried that Jason is going to say to her, you're making this lion more imprinted on humans. You shouldn't be doing this. And she knows it's right. But still, it's an epiphany for her. She lays one arm across her soft flank. I breathe in that exquisite talcum and fresh-cut hay scent. I don't know how a predator can smell like that, but anyway. That indescribable yearning to be cuddled up with her as a member of the royal pride is actually realizable. If I were granted one wish, it would be to shapeshift and join Mara's pride in lioness form, forever one with my sub-lion lion family. She does become a lion shaman, by the way, and communicates telepathically with the lions. But there's also this Oedipalization, because at the beginning she sees the cub as her daughter. Now Mara is her mother, a lion queen. István Prout argues that the gap between animist and conservationist conceptions of animals is much wider than generally acknowledged and doesn't work. But in fact, in Tucker's story, it does work. At one stage, they are trying to release the lioness and her progeny now, into Timbavati, and the collars stop working. And this is really, really bad news. So Linda says to Jason, hang on, let me just communicate telepathically with Mara, because I think she scrambled the technology. So she communicates telepathically with Mara and the other cub that has got a collar. And to Jason's incredulity, the collar stopped working. So, but also problematically about the Timbavati, where she's managed to buy with the support of a fairy godmother, and it's extraordinary. Timbavati is next to one of the poverty nodes of South Africa. And as Haraway reminds us, efforts to preserve nature in parks remain fatally troubled by the ineradicable mark of the founding expulsion of those who used to live there. What Tucker does with her fairy godmother is go to a school and to take white lion teddies. It sounds uncomfortably like white largesse, but actually the school itself puts on a play, and the children sing a song comparing Mara with Nelson Mandela as someone who is great that people want to imprison. So Rose, let me just show you, this was a picture of Mara when she was a cub. You can see the winsomeness of this cub, and the blue eyes, I don't think laughed. But this is when she goes to the school, and they have done, the children have made this puppet of Mara, saying that now order has been restored. And they also tell a story about Maria Corsa, the lion shaman, who has since died. To compare this with a performance at the end of Green Lion, there are also animal-inspired performances, but these are very different. Here, the taxidermied animals are taken from the house and turned into performance animals. Dancers dress up as animals, and everybody is beguiled because there's no more Sekhmet, right? Sekhmet has disappeared. The zoo has no money, so what do? They entrance children with animal-inspired performances. And as Dale Jamieson argues, zoos distract us from the truth about ourselves and what we are doing to nature. How much more does this performance do? And in fact, Haraway says that the center, Animal Center, offers funhouse reflections of oneself. Rose is obviously very cynical about this, and she has one mother say to Con, it's so nice, while she's looking at a puppet, it's so nice for children to see real animals. Taxidermy for Rachel Poliquin exists because of life's inevitable trudge towards dissolution. Taxidermy wants to stop time. This is what conservation will come to, Rose Innes seems to suggest. Stuffed animals being made to perform an utter fabrication, a sop to Edenic longings for close connections with long extinct animals, with no live animals in sight. Sekhmet, who's disappeared, becomes an urban legend. She does maul to death a young, vulnerable girl in a township, which is kind of a parallel with the death of Mark's sister 20 years before on Table Mountain. The ending of Green Lion is haunted by the absence of the lioness and the end of this project to try and backbreed the lions, the Cape lions with the black mane. The ending of Saving the White Lions, on the other hand, has Mara, the celebrity, filmed by three separate film crews, as she moves from the comforting enclosed bomber where carcasses were provided for her and her cubs to the wilderness where she will have to hunt for herself and her offspring for the very first time. Certainly, it's a narrative of redemption. Linda Tucker foregrounds herself as a gladiator and a hero and savior, but the quest to save these white lions is only partially successful. Many white lions, and almost all of them, remained in cairn hunting operations. Aslan, whom Linda Tucker promised face-to-face to save, was killed by a hunter who offered three times what normally would have been asked, so he could pin a white lion head on his wall. So animal capital dominates extensively, as it did in the CITES ruling. Green lion seems a narrative of despair, with real but captive lions supplanted by humans performing with animal prostheses. Wildness has been contained, domesticated, conservation is a safe, predictable performance for children. Thank you. I'll stop there.